Third and final case this morning is Malone versus McCullough Construction. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant, you may approach. Good morning, Mr. Fowles.
Yes. Your Honors, John Fowles on behalf of the plaintiff, Mr. Malone in this case. And this is basically a negligence case arising out of a residential construction project near Firth, Nebraska. I represent the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Malone, who was an employee of Andell Construction. Andell was what I would call one of the subcontractors in this case. I think that's kind of one of the principal issues that the trial court never resolved in this case was basically the relationship between the parties, because I think that's very important for what follows with the two theories of liability that we have made in this case. The general contractor was Miller, and Miller contracted, there's no dispute that Miller originally contracted with McCullough to do the framing on this residential construction project. And McCullough, well, I think it's also, there's some background here, that Miller had multiple houses that he needed constructed. He had McCullough was having trouble getting employees to do the project because there are other projects down the road. So McCullough knew Andell. He contacted Andell and said, I've got some work, I need some help. So Andell, and these were two separate companies, I think that's very important. McCullough had workers' compensation insurance, Andell didn't. McCullough contacts Andell, Andell says, yeah, I got time, I got labor. They start working on this Firth project together. And now I think Miller was, I think, very vague about what he knew about Andell and Andell's role in this project. I think this was a motion for summary judgment, so any inferences should be in favor of the plaintiff in this case. I think when you look at that, Miller clearly knew that Andell was on the project. He was taking advantage of Andell's labor to complete this project.
And so what evidence was there that Miller knew of Andell's involvement?
Well, first of all, Miller and Andell knew each other beforehand. Miller had actually, strangely enough, worked for Andell at one point in time. He knew what Andell's business was. All he would have had to have done was gone to the site and see Andell working on the project to know that Andell had his own company. Secondly,
but did Miller go to the site and see Andell there?
Well, I think there's evidence. I go to the end afterwards. I think there was a phone conversation with the two immediately after the accident happened. I don't know. I can't remember from the record how that instigated, but Andell called Miller, and I think if you read the record, I think McCullough testified that he told Miller that he was using Andell. So I think that in and of itself is sufficient evidence.
But it's still McCullough that asked Andell to come on the job.
Yes, but
And McCullough paid Andell.
Well,
Miller didn't pay Andell.
Yes, that's true.
And
yes.
Miller paid McCullough whatever their agreed upon amount of compensation was.
Yes.
And then McCullough paid Andell, and Andell paid your client.
Well, yes. And I think if your argument there is that didn't obligate Miller to know anything about Andell, I think you're taking, I don't think the statute lets you do that, Your Honor. And I'll circle back to 48.116 because that's obviously the key statute in this case.
But it was McCullough that had the work comp coverage, is that correct?
McCullough had workers' compensation coverage.
And that was extended to Mr. Malone after the accident.
Yes, we reached a settlement. Yes.
Okay. So why are we even talking about Miller under that circumstance?
Well, the reason is, now, Miller did not have workers' compensation insurance, Your Honor. I mean, I think if Miller had workers' compensation insurance, he probably would have also been a defendant in that case. Okay? And we didn't make him a defendant in that case because he did not have workers' compensation insurance.
But this isn't a case where the injured worker had no coverage. The injured worker had coverage that was made available to him.
Well, there. He had to do it through 48.116, excuse me, Your Honor, which isn't the same as your employer having workers' compensation coverage. There were other people injured on this, McCullough and his employees. They had coverage right away. I mean, Miller did not have coverage. He had to file a law. Yeah, Malone.
Yeah. Right, a lot of others here.
Malone had to hire an attorney. Malone had to file a lawsuit to get coverage. That is not the same thing as having coverage, traditional workers' compensation coverage, when you have to go out and hire an attorney to get that coverage in what otherwise would have been a clear, undisputed workers' compensation case with undisputed injuries, Your Honor.
Does that affect his recovery?
Oh, it does, yes. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he's got to hire an attorney. I mean,
he would not necessarily... Get attorney
fees? Oh, yes, okay. Of course. And that, you know, attorneys don't work for free, we're expensive. So yes, it's not the same as
but were attorney fees awarded as a part of that, or do we know?
Well, they weren't, but it's unlikely that they would have been because there would have been no real mechanism for attorney fees under the workers' compensation statute, because there was a dispute about employment under 48.116. So you don't get attorney fees when there's a reasonable dispute, and there certainly would have been. And you also don't get a full recovery when you have a dispute, because you end up compromising. So I think that's a very expedient conclusion for the court to reach, is that he came out the same, because I don't think you can reach that conclusion. It would also probably be a question of fact, too, for a jury to decide, potentially. Now, I agree that Miller would get credit in any claim. And the other thing is, Your Honor, and I circle back to what I said initially, that we could have made Miller a defendant in the workers' compensation case. I think that we could have done that anyway. And that would have certainly made a difference to the other workers' comp, the other employer who had workers' compensation insurance. They would have had potentially a claim. Now, they chose not to really pursue this because of the economics involved, but they're still a defendant in the case, and they still have a subrogation claim, and they still would certainly have an interest in collecting some money from Miller. So I think to just let Miller off the hook and say that, well, the client got his money, or the plaintiff got his money anyway, I think, yeah, I just don't think that's fair to the client. I don't think that's fair to the bigger picture here, which is that Miller, I don't think, met his obligation under 48.116, and that's to find out whether the subcontractors on your project have insurance. He didn't do anything to find out anything about Andel, whether Andel had insurance.
But he did with regard to his subcontractor, McCullough.
He did.
And do you have any authority that it goes then to the subcontractor of the subcontractor?
I've read that statute over and over, and I can't see where it limits it. I don't see where that statute, if you look at the face of that statute, it doesn't limit it. And I would take the court back to the Espinoza case that came down in February of this year from the Nebraska Supreme Court regarding the multiple members. The court in that case cited the beneficent purposes of the Workers' Compensation Act and read the act very broadly. As a plaintiff's attorney who does a lot of workers' comp and was following that case, I was really shocked that the court made that finding in that case. And I think that's evidence of how broadly the Nebraska Supreme Court reads the Workers' Compensation Act. And I think if you look at that statute, 48.116, I don't think it limits how far the court can go down or how far you can go down the contractor list. And the other thing is, I think it's also really unfair to just conclude that Andel was working for McCullough. I think you could also argue that they were just two subcontractors, both working for Miller. And I think if you read the record, I think the court really needed to dig deeper into that and didn't really make any conclusions from which we can gauge how the court was thinking.
There was no written agreement between Miller and Andel. Is that correct?
No, there was no written agreement between Miller and McCullough. There was no written agreement between anyone. This was very informal, I think. And there were multiple projects. This wasn't the only house they were all working on together.
Did Miller require McCullough to show evidence of work comp coverage, though?
I think yes. McCullough had it, and I think there was some evidence Miller asked about McCullough. But again, Your Honor, I think if you just focus, if you're just looking at this project, I think you're missing it, because they were working on other things together, and Miller desperately needed help to get the projects he was working on done, and he really needed Andel. He wasn't going to have enough if he just had McCullough. He needed Andel.
Did he have McCullough on the other projects as
yes,
well?
Yes. They were all working on various projects, and that's all on the record. I'll reserve my balance here.
Okay.
Well, if you have a question.
No, I'll let you reserve your time.
Okay.
That's fine.
Morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Fowles. I represent the appellee in this case, Miller Builders. The question of whether a legal duty exists is a question of law, and our Supreme Court in Gayton versus Walmart has stated that one who employs an independent contractor is not liable for physical harm caused to another by the acts or omissions of that contractor or its servants. That's exactly what we have in this case, Your Honors. During our summary judgment, we met our prima facie case to show that Miller Builders subcontracted with McCullough. There's evidence on the record that Miller paid McCullough directly. Miller did not pay Andel. Also, the question of what Miller knew and who, you know, who employed who, that was answered on the record in Miller's deposition when he was asked, what was your understanding of the relationship of Andel and his employees? And he stated, I thought they worked for McCullough. Miller Builders did everything it was supposed to under the Workers' Compensation Act. It required that McCullough provide it with a certificate of insurance showing that it had operative workers' compensation insurance. To hold that Miller, as the general contractor, is under some duty to go to every single person on the job site and ask them affirmatively, who do you work for? Does your employer have workers' compensation? Miller has no direct contract with Andel. He would have no right to go to Andel and say, provide me with a copy of your workers' comp coverage. There's no contract there that would require him to do that. It was up to McCullough to go to Andel and say, hey, I'm hiring you as a subcontractor, provide me with a copy of your workers' comp coverage. Under that general principle articulated in Gayton, the Nebraska court articulated four exceptions to that general rule. The third exception, and I'll do the third and the fourth exception because they don't apply here. The third exception is a statute or a rule imposes a specific duty on that general contractor, and the court in the same case said that that does not apply to roofers or framers. There's no statute that imposes a specific duty. And the fourth exception is that a contractor's work involves special risks or dangers. Again, also in Gayton, the special risks or dangers exception to the general rule of non-liability does not apply in the context of personal injury claims by employees of subcontractors against general. So those two exceptions are out. The first exception is that the general contractor retains control over the subcontractor's work. Here in this case, there's no dispute about that factor, and the court has said that that oversight must be substantial, and then articulated an additional three requirements to uphold a finding that that general contractor retained control over that subcontractor's work. General contractor supervised the work that caused the injury. We have here on the record, there is no dispute that Miller Builders supervised any of the framing work. He's not a framer. And to hold that he would be required to walk the job site and check for the quality of the framer's work is a slippery slope. You would have general contractors going and checking the work of electricians, the work of plumbers, and they're just not qualified to do that. That's why they hire subcontractors, and they rely on those subcontractors to do the work according to the generally accepted principles.
But aren't they still, as general contractor, aren't they still the captain of the ship, if you will? They hire the sub, and even though they may not be framers themselves, they have some duty to inspect and make sure it's meeting building code standards and things like that?
Well, certainly they would have the obligation to make sure that when there are certain steps of the project, such as permitting, the permitting officer comes through and checks to make sure that those all comply with the requirements. But I don't think that a general contractor in this context has the capacity to go and start checking bracing on overhanging roofs, which is the point of failure in this case, and say how that bracing doesn't comply with OSHA standards.
I know a lot of home builders in Omaha who started out as framers.
Certainly.
And then started becoming general contractors and building homes.
But I think, Your Honor, if they start doing that, it's a slippery slope to then hold them to say that, hey, they qualify for that first exception, that they retained control over the work of the subcontractor. So the court articulates a rule of non-liability and then four exceptions. And then if the general contractor then goes and starts double-checking all of the work of all of its subs, it is then subjecting itself to that first exception, that it retained the work, or it retained control over the work. Secondly, in order to uphold a finding that the general contractor retained substantial oversight, there must be a finding that general contractor had actual or constructive knowledge of the danger. Again, there is no evidence on the record. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary that Dustin Miller, as he did when he did go to the job site, did not go and check the bracing on this work. In fact, he testified that he had supplied the concrete footings and the bracing, the underpinnings, that would have been required to comply with OSHA standards, but that those were not used by his subcontractor, unbeknownst to him.
So we've talked about the negligence theory. Let's circle back, if you will, to the statutory 48.116 and counsel's argument that a broad interpretation should apply to a subcontractor of a subcontractor.
Well, again, I read that that requirement in 48.119 that exempts contractors that request workers' compensation coverage from its subs from the requirements of that act. That has been complied with. Miller Builders hired one framing subcontractor, McCullough Construction. They made sure that McCullough Construction provided them with a copy of a valid workers' compensation coverage policy, and that clearly falls within the clear language of that exception in that act. Again, I know that the appellant in this case relies on Martinez versus CMR Construction and tries to find commonality with this case and that, but there's a large distinguishing factor in that case in that the workers' compensation coverage that was provided to the general contractor as proof was not applicable. It applied to Texas only, and it did not apply to the injury, and therefore the court found that that the general contractor did not comply with the requirements of that act. In this case, we have an actual workers' compensation policy that applied to the injuries of Mr. Malone. I don't want to get into the exclusive remedy arguments, but Mr. Malone had an opportunity to apply for workers' compensation coverage as his exclusive remedy, and he did so. Arguments that his remedy was somehow lessened because of the settlement in that case, I think it's a red herring. In fact, had Mr. Malone wanted to pursue that case to an ultimate decision and request attorney's fees by stating that, hey, this coverage is clear, I was an employee of a subcontractor, McCullough did not check to see if Andel had workers' compensation coverage, therefore this clearly applies, he would have had the ability to get a full compensation just like the other injured parties on this case, and he chose to enter into a settlement. In fact, I don't know what that settlement is, but he availed himself to the coverage that was available. With regard to that second the second exception in Gayton, that a general contractor is in possession and control of the premises, the court has articulated that even if there was a finding that Miller Builders had control and possession of the premises, that the possessor of the premises cannot be held liable under that exception when the subcontractor's employee is injured due to a specific action or inactions involved in the construction process. Again, that's exactly what we have in this case. Statement of fact number 19 in our motion for summary judgment was an admitted statement of fact. It appears on the record at T64. And the parties agreed that the cause of the collapse was due to the improper construction of the standard temporary brace supporting the partially constructed roof. The parties also agreed that the temporary brace was fashioned with nails instead of screws, thus it did not secure the weight properly, and that the temporary brace was constructed by Andel Building. Again, the parties agree as to what the defect was, who was responsible for that defect, and there is no allegation that Miller Builders was in any way involved with the construction of that temporary brace. Again, with regard to appellant's argument that there needs to be additional findings, we have the statements of the parties at their depositions that was offered and accepted by the court. Mr. Andel testified at his deposition that he did not communicate at all with Mr. Miller regarding the Firth project, and that's the name of the project that the parties gave. And he also did not know about Miller's knowledge of the agreement between Andel and McCullough. Again, Miller testified that it was his assumption that anybody else on the project had been hired by McCullough, the subcontractor that he had hired to complete the framing on this project. Your Honors, I am out of time, and with that, I would ask that you affirm the decision of the district court in granting summary judgment in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time did Mr. Fowles have left?
1 minute, 1 second.
Okay. For rebuttal.
Well, you know, I guess the one thing I would reiterate is that I think there are factual issues about what Miller knew and what he should have known about Andel. I think I tried to get into those in the brief, but I think the court really took the option or the ability to really play that out in a courtroom by ruling about that issue on summary judgment. And again, I'd also point out the court never really indicated what its position was on those issues. I mean, it just kind of said at the end that Miller, McCullough had work comp, and it didn't really indicate anything about how conclusions it made about the relationship between the parties.
I'm going to come back to the question that I had. It seems to me that under your argument, that Miller would have to check with every worker on the job site to find out if they are an employee or an independent contractor or a subcontractor of the subcontractor that you hired. And then once you determine whether they're an employee, then go into the workers' comp. It seems to me that's the burden that you're asking the court to impose on a general contractor. Am I missing something there?
Yeah, I think you are, Your Honor. I think there are two things to understand. I think that's why there are factual issues that are going undiscussed in this case, at least with the trial court. And that is that this was a very small, this was a singular house project. There weren't a lot of people on this project, but there were other housing projects. They had other deadlines. And I just think the evidence indicates that Miller knew more about Andel than he was ever letting on. I think McCullough indicated that he told Miller about Andel.
And this whole knowledge of Andel, then that feeds your argument that he should have checked to see if Andel had workers' comp? Is that the basis of this knowledge?
Yes. There's a unique circumstance here, Your Honor, that Miller actually worked for Andel at one point in time. He knew Andel had his own company. So I think there was a familiarity there that a bell should have gone off. And I mean, that's a question of fact. I think you're right, Your Honor. There may be circumstances where there's just too much going on that they have no reason to know. But I think if there's a reason that they should know, or that they know that there's potentially another contractor on this case, on this project, that they should be trying to find out whether that contractor has workers' compensation insurance before they let them on the job. But again, I think that's just a question of fact. And I think the court decided that on its own in this case, and I think that was a question for a jury, not for the judge.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. We will take it under advisement, and you are excused, and we are adjourned.